This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Thumbtack presents the ins and outs of caring for your home. Out. Uncertainty. Self-doubt. Stressing about not knowing where to start. In. Plans and guides that make it easy to get home projects done. Out. Word art. Sorry, live, laugh, lovers. In. Knowing what to do, when to do it, and who to hire. Start caring for your home with confidence. Download Thumbtack today.
Street Easy knows former New Yorkers never stop talking about how much they miss living in NYC.
Life used to feel like a movie, but since we left and bought a house, it's like living in a DIY home repair video.
When it's time to buy, let Street Easy connect you with the right agent you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
You're listening to KCBS In-Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area's talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In-Depth.
From Odyssey's I'm Listening, in partnership with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, welcome to a special conversation with the Chief Medical Officer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Dr. Christine Moutier, and former Surgeon General, Dr. Jerome Adams. Today, they are discussing mental health conversations for teens, adolescents, and parents. Now, Dr. Christine Moutier.
Dr. Adams, you are an incredible person and physician and leader. You've been a practicing trauma physician in an inner city. You've been Indiana State Health Commissioner. You've been the 20th U.S. Surgeon General and leading a public health effort around any number of types of crises using the public health model to address, you know, infectious disease, a pandemic, national and regional disasters, and the opioid crisis as well. And you're a father. And so
I know you make me sound old when you say all those things. Gosh, it's a lot.
It is amazing. So yeah, we would just love to hear your perspective from all of your, you know, professional roles you've had, your lived experience as a father and community leader, and particularly thinking about our youth in any area of the country, including areas where there are health disparities, absolutely, for different populations. We just love your perspective on what's going on with our youth and thinking through that public health lens, perhaps first, before we get to the personal level.
Well, exactly. And the public health lens is so important. But I'm going to back up a little bit. One of the last things you said is actually one of the most important to me. Accolades and past jobs aside, the most important job I have is that of being a father to three teenagers. I've seen really the mental health of our youth collectively decline over the last decade or so. I've seen many of the struggles that my own kids face. I've seen their friends struggle with mental health. And of course, all of these teenagers lived through, and young adults lived through, a once in a century pandemic that was superimposed on top of a social justice movement that's unlike anything we've had in the last 50 years. And add into that an incredibly contentious political environment. And there's just a lot out there that really is placing additional stress on young people. Well, what's interesting is that I know we've got an audience here that's not all medical professionals. When you apply that model to mental health and particularly to risk for suicide, it's okay, what are the stressors that are around you? And as I've mentioned, stressors are at an all-time high. Social media, bullying, again, the pandemic, isolation. And I worry from a public health model that to counteract those stressors, we aren't doing the things that we can and should be doing as a society to build resilience individually, but also in a community. And that's resulted in an increase in suicide attempts and thoughts about suicide in young people. 1.6 million people reported a suicide attempt in 2022. It was one of the 9 leading causes of death. And I think it's important for people also to understand that this data, we're talking about 2022 data, because from an epidemiological standpoint, you have to wait for the year to end before you can look at data. Regardless, we're seeing record increases, particularly for youth aged 10 to 24. And I want to highlight a few particular at-risk groups. Black youth have seen an alarming increase of 87%. LGBTQ plus individuals are experiencing higher rates of mental health concerns. American Indian and Alaskan Native populations seeing higher rates. And then people living in rural areas for any number of reasons, isolation, economic challenges, et cetera. So I don't want to go on because I want this to be a conversation, but I do want people to understand we're seeing suicide thoughts, suicide attempts increase. We're seeing it happen disproportionately in some populations, and we need to understand that. And it's happening because youth are facing unprecedented stressors and they don't have the supports around them and the resources and skills to be able to deal with these increased stressors.
Yes, Dr. Adams, thank you so much for just kind of going over some of the very concerning trends in the data related to mental health, suicidal ideation, attempts, and even suicide rates. And, you know, I'm thinking about the fact that mental health is complex. Suicide is a devastating and complex health outcome as well. And we've seen successes with other really strong public health strategies when you invest in an evidence-informed approach at all of the tiers of a public health model, that you can actually reverse other leading causes of death. Have seen some successes with this full kind of national scale investment. And we at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention actually remain hopeful that as stigma is going down, more and more people are able to talk about their mental health needs, to talk about any stresses we're going through, and certainly if we're having suicidal thoughts. And it's okay to ask someone if they are having thoughts of ending their life. But
and that's a big change. I don't want to stop you here while you're in a group, but I do want to highlight something you just said. It is okay to ask someone because when I was growing up, and that was, it wasn't that long ago, when I was in medical school, there was a real fear that you could plant the idea in someone's head simply by asking them the question. We now know that that's not true. We know that actually by asking someone how they're doing, asking them if they're okay, asking them if they're having thoughts about suicide, you actually can intervene and lower their chances of attempting or completing suicide. And you certainly, there's no data out there now that, at all that suggests that you're going to increase their chances of dying by suicide by asking the question. So it is okay not to be okay. And it's okay to ask someone if they're okay.
I so agree with you. And even furthermore, there are several studies, I think it's 4 or 5 at least, that have really refuted that myth that asking about thoughts of suicides can do harm. And that in fact, what we know at AFSP, because of all of the families and communities with lived experience, is that once we're able to just really knock down those barriers of stigma, fear, shame, and understand that these are human experiences. Suffering is unfortunately a part of being human, and facing any number of challenges is a normal part of life. And we can share that burden together, that the more we open up and connect, that people who are having thoughts of suicide, when they get a chance to talk about it, oftentimes that's a relief. And it's the first step, hopefully among a number of steps, where they actually can connect to help and support, and ideally to mental health treatment when that's necessary and helpful as well.
Well, yeah. It's a good time to plug something that I know you and I are both passionate about, and that's 988. That is the National Crisis Prevention Hotline. And so we talked a lot about some of the bad trends, but I think it's important for people to understand that something really positive has happened in the last couple of years, and that's the new Crisis Prevention Hotline 988. So if you are feeling thoughts of suicide, if you just want someone to talk to, you can dial 988. This was at a time when political turmoil is at an all-time high. 988 is a number that's available all over the United States for people to call. So if you are hurting, if you're struggling, remember, you can dial 988 and you will be connected with professionals who can help you deal with your crisis.
Oh, I love that you shared that. And, you know, more people than ever before are accessing 988 and chatting or texting or calling. All of those are options. They now have Spanish speaking, and there's an LGBTQ as well as military and veteran, you know, certain digits to press. There's research that also shows that people are experiencing tremendous support, are brought down from their state of possible crisis. And I will just add, you don't actually have to be in a full-blown crisis. You can call with any level of mental health concerns. And you can also call if you're the one helping someone else and you're just not sure what to do next. So thank you so much for mentioning that, Dr. Adams.
You know, you talked about a public health approach to suicide. And in 2021, before I left office, one of the last things I did was put out a Surgeon General's call to action on suicide prevention. And the very first point that I make in that call to action is that we need to activate a broad-based public health response to suicide. But I don't think a lot of people understand what that means. And so I just want to really quickly walk people through what a public health response looks like. One of the things I highlight is that we need to broaden perceptions of suicide, who is affected, and the factors that can affect suicide risk. So a public health approach is really looking at the entire population and helping us understand who is at risk, as opposed to pointing fingers and saying, oh, it's only those people, or it could never be those people. We need to empower all individuals and organizations to play a role in suicide prevention. That's what a public health response looks like. So schools, workplaces, home environments, sports teams, everyone can play a role in recognizing if you yourself are struggling or if someone around you is struggling. We need to engage people with lived experience. That is a public health approach. So we talk about peer support. One of the most powerful means to intervene is to connect someone who's struggling with someone who they can relate to or someone who's been through it before. I think that's incredibly important. And then we need to use effective communications to engage diverse sectors in suicide prevention, so that ultimately we can get upstream and prevent suicide. A lot of people think, it's another thing that we need to dispel as a myth. They think that someone who dies by suicide, that was just going to happen. No matter what you do, that was going to happen. No, we have lots of data, lots of evidence now that shows that if we can intervene, we can prevent people from dying by suicide. So that's what a public health approach means. And I want people to understand it. It's yes, there are things we can focus on for the individual. As an individual, if you're hurting, call 988. But the public health approach is, and if you're seeing someone who's struggling and you're in the community, you can call 988. It's taking it from the individual to the community. There are things we can do to build resilience in individuals, but there are also things we can do to build community resilience by promoting connectedness, getting people involved in sports and school activities, et cetera. And I want people to really understand that, because I don't want folks to think, well, I'm fine, so I don't need to listen to this to this conversation, or I don't need to think about this. Number one, you never know when it could occur that you're not fine. But number two, you never know when you might have the opportunity in your life to save someone else's life.
Oh, my goodness. 100% on all of that. And I love that you just detailed for us kind of those layers of the public health approach that are very actionable. And, you know, amongst this listening audience, there are all kinds of roles, individuals, hats that folks are wearing. And we know that in the field of mental health and particularly suicide prevention, everyone has a role to play in preventing suicide. And I think the first step is just learning and accessing some education so that you understand there is no stigma, there is no shame. Mental health is a part of human health, just like any other.
In Depth will return after a moment.
Dr. Adams, I'm thinking, you know, you and I both went through the academic medical culture, and you know, there was a lot of that actually back in the day where you didn't dare kind of talk about your struggles because it might jeopardize your career in some way. And exactly. That's no longer the case. That really does not have to be that way.
Well, we still have work to do. I want people to know that we've made a lot of progress. But I also, again, going back to the public health approach, want people to understand that we all have a role in lowering stigma. One of the things that I'm doing that's kind of cool and also I think very impactful is working with sports leagues. So I've worked with the NBA. I've worked with the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and I've helped many former athletes share their stories about mental health and how focusing on their mental health has helped them become better in their day-to-day lives as athletes. But also for some of them, it's really saved their lives. And I think when we can have people like Kevin Love, NBA player, like Peyton Manning and many of the Colts who have their Kicking the Stigma campaign around mental health going on, talking about mental health, then it makes it okay for other people to have these conversations. Interestingly enough, I mean, and maybe you agree, maybe you disagree, Doc, but I feel like in many cases, the medical community still remains far behind many other aspects of society in being able to have these open conversations. I think there's still a stigma, unfortunately, amongst physicians and medical trainees about being open about mental health issues that doesn't really exist anymore or as much in other professions. So I think we've got some work to do as physicians, as healthcare providers, to walk the talk really in this space.
I love that you're bringing this up so much, because the reason I'm involved in my whole life's work is around suicide prevention was due to the loss of physician and medical student colleagues to suicide in my own career and alongside and it occurring after my own mental health lived experience journey. You know, it was sort of like my secret mission, staying in academic medicine all of those years. And I justified it by exactly what you're saying, which I do believe that if we can't be real and honest as physicians, as health leaders amongst the community around mental health and suicide prevention, how are we going to do right by our patients? Yes. And, you know, now at AFSP, I have the opportunity, just like you're talking about, to be involved with different industries and workplaces and sports teams. And you kind of, you know, so among law enforcement, for example, among the veteran community, among the construction community, which unfortunately does have much higher rates of suicide. There are different versions of kind of the same stigma, though, throughout all those different occupations and groups. But I actually share your view that, you know, as medical professionals and just healthcare professionals, we really have an additional responsibility to become much more educated and really to shed stigma. You know, we have to be able to be approachable. our clinic and our office environment should be a place where patients can bring their whole level of concerns as human beings. And we know that mental health is part of health. And yet in so many healthcare environments, it almost feels like it doesn't fit or belong. I'm very excited to talk about one, not new, but new-ish development. AFSP partnered with the American Academy of Pediatricians, who were very interested in the mental health and suicide risk reduction amongst their patient population. And certainly during COVID, you know, pediatricians and many physicians were on the front line. And so together and with about 100 other organizations and people with lived experience, we developed something called the National Blueprint for Youth Suicide Prevention. And it really brings together the evidence and the lived experience voice and the public health approach to really attack this issue in as kind of a full bore way, in a way that it deserves. And I think that's
evidence-based way. We have lots of really good evidence, right? Evidence-based interventions, but we need to make sure they're being applied. So we know that we should routinely recommend vaccinations when someone comes in for a pediatric visit. And we know what the schedule of vaccinations are. We know that we should talk about certain other things that are high risk. But and mental health is also something that we should be talking about in a standardized and evidence-based way. And so I'm so glad that you highlighted that in your work with AAP, because one of the actions in my call to action on suicide prevention from 2021 was to support adoption of evidence-based care for suicide risk, including increasing clinical training in evidence-based care, improving suicide risk identification in all healthcare settings. We aren't doing appropriate screening and identification. We need to conduct safety planning with all patients who screen positive for suicide risk. And we need to increase the use of suicide care pathways in healthcare systems for individuals who are then identified as at risk. Because to be fair to clinicians, we're taught, don't do a lab test if you're not going to do anything with the results. We're taught that in medical school. And so when it comes to mental health, I do want to be fair to providers. In many cases, they're afraid or they're simply following what they've been taught and not asking about mental health and suicide risk because they don't know what to do when someone screens positive. So again, that's the public health system-wide approach. We need to make sure there are care pathways in place, the same as there are if we identify any other physical risk factor. Oh, you've got a hurt ankle? Let's get an x-ray. Oh, it's broken. Oh, let's send you to the orthopedic surgeon. We know what to do for a broken ankle. We don't know what to do, quite frankly, in many cases, for a broken heart. And we need to make sure we're giving more clinicians and more clinical settings the evidence-based tools to know what to do.
Yes, yes, yes. And when you released that strong advisory and urging around suicide prevention, you know, I was just really celebrating that moment because you were shining a light on all of the new science that does tell us what to do to identify risk, to be able to take actions, just like you're outlining, supportive conversations, educate the patient, the family, safety planning intervention, lethal means counseling. You know, I always tell my friends and my girlfriends who call, if their child is suffering or their loved one in the home might be having thoughts of suicide, in addition to having those caring, supportive conversations and helping lead them to, you know, proper treatment and support, the other number one thing they can do to help keep their loved one safe is to clear the environment of lethal means as much as possible. And, you know, that if the family is a firearm-owning family, then absolutely that includes temporarily storing those guns outside the home if possible. But it also means any toxic substances, medications, sharps, get them out of harm's way and really secure them. And the truth is, this kind of suffering and crisis does not go on forever. It's a circumscribed period of time. Yes. And people do find their resilience and their, you know, that survival instinct and their sense of hope for the future. It's a very dynamic process in a person's life. So they do come back to that.
It's not about taking away people's guns or gun control. It's about understanding that, as you mentioned, if we can keep someone who's in a very low state away from a lethal means, then we can get them through that acute event. That's what we mean when we say lethal means safety. And there are simple things like making sure you keep your guns locked up if you do have guns in your house, so they're not easily accessible. There are simple things like making sure if someone is having a mental health crisis, that you have a conversation with them and their loved ones about what lethal means exist around the house. And how can we make sure we've got an eye on them and that they're secured to not have them available to someone when they're in an acute low moment? And so I just wanted to be very clear on that for folks, because this conversation about gun control and no one's going to take away my guns has obscured, I think, a much more important conversation about the fact that there are things that everyone agrees we can and should be doing to limit access to lethal means for people who are at risk of dying by suicide.
Thank you so much for highlighting that, because I think what binds all of us together, no matter what our other views are, is we all care about our loved ones. We all want ourselves and our community members, our friends and family, to be thriving and finding meaning and purpose and staying alive and really optimizing our mental health. So thank you so much for that. You know, I think one last conversation topic that I'd love to hear your thoughts on relates to social media and online, you know, screen activity and, you know, the fact that there was a temporal association between the onset of and the utilization of social media and screen time and some of the mental health distress and in fact, rising suicide rates. But association and correlation does not necessarily mean causation. And the literature is a little complicated around that relationship between social media and mental health. So I would love to know your thoughts about that. And particularly because you have teenage kids, you know, how are you approaching this, you know, rather tricky subject that is just ubiquitous? I mean, everybody's got their screens and everyone is on, I shouldn't say everyone is on social media. Many people are using social media platforms.
No, it is really tough. And again, as you mentioned, I do have to kind of split my thinking about this up into buckets. As a parent, I am struggling just like every other parent out there to try to manage my children's usage of social media and screen time. And it is hard because one of the things that we can't ignore is that young people use Snapchat. They use these social media platforms as a way of communicating the way that we used our old phone that was wired into the wall back in the day to communicate with one another. And I'll give folks a concrete example, because it's easy to say social media is all bad, but here's why it's complicated. If you are someone who identifies as LGBTQ+, and you are in a rural community where there is no one around you who you see, who you know, who you can talk to about issues that are unique to you, then social media and screen time can be a lifeline for you. It can be a way to connect you to people who think like you, who look like you, who talk like you, who are going through the same struggles as you. So there can be good things that come out of it.
You can find this episode and past episodes of In-Depth online at kcbsradio.com. You can also hear In-Depth episodes on the Odyssey app. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In-Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.
College holds a mythic place in American culture. On the new Campus Files podcast, we uncover the scandals you won't hear on the campus tours. Find Campus Files on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to KCBS In Depth.
Really, in order to find quality care, you often have to be on a wait list that's months long.
The people, places, and issues the Bay Area is talking about.
The aggressive advocates who were looking to overrule Roe for so long, they really had no idea of the consequences they might be opening up.
In this case, there very well may be charges that are appropriate. For example, trying to obstruct an official proceeding of Congress, right? That is unlawful.
This is KCBS In Depth.
From Odyssey's I'm Listening, in partnership with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, welcome to a special conversation with the Chief Medical Officer for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Dr. Christine Moutier, and former Surgeon General, Dr. Jerome Adams. Today, they are discussing mental health conversations for teens, adolescents, and parents. Now, Dr. Christine Moutier.
Dr. Adams, you are an incredible person and physician and leader. You've been a practicing trauma physician in an inner city. You've been Indiana State Health Commissioner. You've been the 20th U.S. Surgeon General and leading a public health effort around any number of types of crises using the public health model to address, you know, infectious disease, a pandemic, national and regional disasters, and the opioid crisis as well. And you're a father. And so
I know you make me sound old when you say all those things. Gosh, it's a lot.
It is amazing. So yeah, we would just love to hear your perspective from all of your, you know, professional roles you've had, your lived experience as a father and community leader, and particularly thinking about our youth in any area of the country, including areas where there are health disparities, absolutely, for different populations. We just love your perspective on what's going on with our youth and thinking through that public health lens, perhaps first, before we get to the personal level.
Well, exactly. And the public health lens is so important, but I'm going to back up a little bit. One of the last things you said is actually one of the most important to me. Accolades and past jobs aside, the most important job I have is that of being a father to three teenagers. I've seen really the mental health of our youth collectively decline over the last decade or so. I've seen many of the struggles that my own kids face. I've seen their friends struggle with mental health. And of course, all of these teenagers lived through, and young adults lived through, a once in a century pandemic that was superimposed on top of a social justice movement that's unlike anything we've had in the last 50 years. And add into that an incredibly contentious political environment. And there's just a lot out there that really is placing additional stress on young people. Well, what's interesting is that I know we've got an audience here that's not all medical professionals. When you apply that model to mental health and particularly to risk for suicide, it's, okay, what are the stressors that are around you? And as I've mentioned, stressors are at an all-time high. Social media, bullying. Again, the pandemic, isolation, and I worry from a public health model that to counteract those stressors, we aren't doing the things that we can and should be doing as a society to build resilience individually, but also in a community. And that's resulted in an increase in suicide attempts and thoughts about suicide in young people. 1.6 million people reported a suicide attempt in 2022. It was one of the 9 leading causes of death. And I think it's important for people also to understand that this data, we're talking about 2022 data, because from an epidemiological standpoint, you have to wait for the year to end before you can look at data. Regardless, we're seeing record increases, particularly for youth aged 10 to 24. And I want to highlight a few particular at-risk groups. Black youth have seen an alarming increase of 87%. LGBTQ plus individuals are experiencing higher rates of mental health concerns. American Indian and Alaskan Native populations seeing higher rates. And then people living in rural areas for any number of reasons, isolation, economic challenges, et cetera. So I don't want to go on because I want this to be a conversation, but I do want people to understand we're seeing suicide thoughts, suicide attempts increase. We're seeing it happen disproportionately in some populations, and we need to understand that. And it's happening because youth are facing unprecedented stressors and they don't have the supports around them and the resources and skills to be able to deal with these increased stressors.
Yes, Dr. Adams, thank you so much for just kind of going over some of the very concerning trends in the data related to mental health, suicidal ideation, attempts, and even suicide rates. And, you know, I'm thinking about the fact that mental health is complex. Suicide is a devastating and complex health outcome as well. And we've seen successes with other really strong public health strategies when you invest in an evidence-informed approach at all of the tiers of a public health model, that you can actually reverse other leading causes of death. Have seen some successes with this full kind of national scale investment. And we at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention actually remain hopeful that as stigma is going down, more and more people are able to talk about their mental health needs, to talk about any stresses we're going through, and certainly if we're having suicidal thoughts. And it's okay to ask someone if they are having thoughts of ending their life. But
that's a big change. I don't want to stop you here while you're in a group, but I do want to highlight something you just said. It is okay to ask someone because when I was growing up, and that was, it wasn't that long ago, when I was in medical school, there was a real fear that you could plant the idea in someone's head simply by asking them the question. We now know that that's not true. We know that actually by asking someone how they're doing, asking them if they're okay, asking them if they're having thoughts about suicide, you actually can intervene and lower their chances of attempting or completing suicide. And you certainly, there's no data out there now that, at all, that suggests that you're going to increase their chances of dying by suicide by asking the question. So it is okay not to be okay. And it's okay to ask someone if they're okay.
I so agree with you. And even furthermore, there are several studies, I think it's 4 or 5 at least, that have really refuted that myth that asking about thoughts of suicides can do harm. And that in fact, what we know at AFSP, because of all of the families and communities with lived experience, is that once we're able to just really knock down those barriers of stigma, fear, shame, and understand that these are human experiences. Suffering is unfortunately a part of being human, and facing any number of challenges is a normal part of life. And we can share that burden together, that the more we open up and connect, that people who are having thoughts of suicide, when they get a chance to talk about it, oftentimes that's a relief, and it's the first step, hopefully among a number of steps, where they actually can connect to help and support, and ideally to mental health treatment when that's necessary and helpful as well.
Well, yeah. It's a good time to plug something that I know you and I are both passionate about, and that's 988. That is the National Crisis Prevention Hotline. And so we talked a lot about some of the bad trends, but I think it's important for people to understand that something really positive has happened in the last couple of years, and that's the new crisis prevention hotline, 988. So if you are feeling thoughts of suicide, if you just want someone to talk to, you can dial 988. This was at a time when political turmoil is at an all-time high. 988 is a number that's available all over the United States for people to call. So if you are hurting, if you're struggling, remember, you can dial 988 and you will be connected with professionals who can help you deal with your crisis.
Oh, I love that you shared that. And, you know, more people than ever before are accessing 988 and chatting or texting or calling. All of those are options. They now have Spanish speaking, and there's an LGBTQ as well as military and veteran, you know, certain digits to press. There's research that also shows that people are experiencing tremendous support, are brought down from their state of possible crisis. And I will just add, you don't actually have to be in a full-blown crisis. You can call with any level of mental health concerns. And you can also call if you're the one helping someone else and you're just not sure what to do next. So thank you so much for mentioning that, Dr. Adams.
I would just love take a second and really... Yeah. You know, you talked about a public health approach to suicide. And in 2021, before I left office, one of the last things I did was put out a Surgeon General's call to action on suicide prevention. And the very first point that I make in that call to action is that we need to activate a broad-based public health response to suicide. But I don't think a lot of people understand what that means. And so I just want to really quickly walk people through what a public health response looks like. One of the things I highlight is that we need to broaden perceptions of suicide, who is affected, and the factors that can affect suicide risk. So a public health approach is really looking at the entire population and helping us understand who is at risk, as opposed to pointing fingers and saying, oh, it's only those people, or it could never be those people. We need to empower all individuals and organizations to play a role in suicide prevention. That's what a public health response looks like. So schools, workplaces, home environments, sports teams, everyone can play a role in recognizing if you yourself are struggling or if someone around you is struggling. We need to engage people with lived experience. That is a public health approach. So we talk about peer support. One of the most powerful means to intervene is to connect someone who's struggling with someone who they can relate to or someone who's been through it before. I think that's incredibly important. And then we need to use effective communications to engage diverse sectors in suicide prevention, so that ultimately we can get upstream and prevent suicide. A lot of people think it's another thing that we need to dispel as a myth. They think that someone who dies by suicide, that was just going to happen. No matter what you do, that was going to happen. No, we have lots of data, lots of evidence now that shows that if we can intervene, we can prevent people from dying by suicide. So that's what a public health approach means. And I want people to understand it. It's yes, there are things we can focus on for the individual. As an individual, if you're hurting, call 988. But the public health approach is, and if you're seeing someone who's struggling and you're in the community, you can call 988. It's taking it from the individual to the community. There are things we can do to build resilience in individuals, but there are also things we can do to build community resilience by promoting connectedness, getting people involved in sports and school activities, et cetera. And I want people to really understand that, because I don't want folks to think, well, I'm fine, so I don't need to listen to this conversation, or I don't need to think about this. Number one, you never know when it could occur that you're not fine. But number two, you never know when you might have the opportunity in your life to save someone else's life.
Oh, my goodness. 100% on all of that. And I love that you just detailed for us kind of those layers of the public health approach that are very actionable. And, you know, amongst this listening audience, there are all kinds of roles, individuals, hats that folks are wearing. And we know that in the field of mental health and particularly suicide prevention, everyone has a role to play in preventing suicide. And I think the first step is just learning and accessing some education so that you understand there is no stigma, there is no shame. Mental health is a part of human health, just like any other.
In Depth will return after a moment.
Dr. Adams, I'm thinking, you know, you and I both went through the academic medical culture. And, you know, there was a lot of that actually back in the day where you didn't dare kind of talk about your struggles because it might jeopardize your career in some way. And that's no longer the case. That really does not have to be that way.
Well, we still have work to do. I want people to know that we've made a lot of progress. But I also, again, going back to the public health approach, want people to understand that we all have a role in lowering stigma. One of the things that I'm doing that's kind of cool and also I think very impactful is working with sports leagues. So I've worked with the NBA. I've worked with the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And I've helped many former athletes share their stories about mental health and how focusing on their mental health has helped them become better in their day-to-day lives as athletes. But also for some of them, it's really saved their lives. And I think when we can have people like Kevin Love, NBA player, like Peyton Manning and many of the Colts who have their Kicking the Stigma campaign around mental health going on, talking about mental health, then it makes it okay for other people to have these conversations. Interestingly enough, I mean, and maybe you agree, maybe you disagree, Doc, but I feel like in many cases, the medical community still remains far behind many other aspects of society in being able to have these open conversations. I think there's still a stigma, unfortunately, amongst physicians and medical trainees about being open about mental health issues that doesn't really exist anymore or as much in other professions. So I think we've got some work to do as physicians, as healthcare providers, to walk the talk really in this space.
I love that you're bringing this up so much because the reason I'm involved in my whole life's work is around suicide prevention was due to the loss of physician and medical student colleagues to suicide in my own career and alongside and it occurring after my own mental health lived experience journey. You know, it was sort of like my secret mission, staying in academic medicine all those years. And I justified it by exactly what you're saying, which I do believe that if we can't be real and honest as physicians, as health leaders amongst the community around mental health and suicide prevention, how are we going to do right by our patients? Yes. And, you know, now at AFSP, I have the opportunity just like you're talking about, to be involved with different industries and workplaces and sports teams. And you kind of, you know, so I've with among law enforcement, for example, among the veteran community, among the construction community, which unfortunately does have much higher rates of suicide. There are different versions of kind of the same stigma, though, throughout all those different occupations and groups. But I actually share your view that, you know, as medical professionals and just healthcare professionals, we really have an additional responsibility to become much more educated and really to shed stigma. You know, we have to be able to be approachable. And our clinic and our office environment should be a place where patients can bring their whole level of concerns as human beings. And we know that mental health is part of health. And yet in so many healthcare environments, it almost feels like it doesn't fit or belong. I'm very excited to talk about one, not new, but new-ish development. AFSP partnered with the American Academy of Pediatricians, who were very interested in the mental health and suicide risk reduction amongst their patient population. And certainly during COVID, you know, pediatricians and many physicians were on the front line. And so together and with about 100 other organizations and people with lived experience, we developed something called the National Blueprint for Youth Suicide Prevention. And it really brings together the evidence and the lived experience voice and the public health approach to really attack this issue in as kind of a full bore way, in a way that it deserves. And I think
that's evidence-based way. We have lots of really good evidence right now, evidence-based interventions but we need to make sure they're being applied. So we know that we should routinely recommend vaccinations when someone comes in for a pediatric visit. And we know what the schedule of vaccinations are. We know that we should talk about certain other things that are high risk. But and mental health is also something that we should be talking about in a standardized and evidence-based way. And so I'm so glad that you highlighted that in your work with AAP, because one of the actions in my call to action on suicide prevention from 2021 was to support adoption of evidence-based care for suicide risk, including increasing clinical training in evidence-based care, improving suicide risk identification in all healthcare settings. We aren't doing appropriate screening and identification. We need to conduct safety planning with all patients who screen positive for suicide risk. And we need to increase the use of suicide care pathways in healthcare systems for individuals who are then identified as at risk. Because to be fair to clinicians, we're taught, don't do a lab test if you're not going to do anything with the results. We're taught that in medical school. And so when it comes to mental health, I do want to be fair to providers. In many cases, they're afraid or they're simply following what they've been taught and not asking about mental health and suicide risk because they don't know what to do when someone screens positive. So again, that's the public health system-wide approach. We need to make sure there are care pathways in place, the same as there are if we identify any other physical risk factor. Oh, you've got a hurt ankle? Let's get an x-ray. Oh, it's broken. Oh, let's send you to the orthopedic surgeon. You know, we know what to do for a broken ankle. We don't know what to do, quite frankly, in many cases for a broken heart. And we need to make sure we're giving more clinicians and more clinical settings the evidence-based tools to know what to do.
Yes, yes, yes. And when you released that strong advisory and urging around suicide prevention, you know, I was just really celebrating that moment because you were shining a light on all of the new science that does tell us what to do to identify risk, to be able to take actions, just like you're outlining, supportive conversations, educate the patient, the family, safety planning intervention, lethal means counseling. You know, I always tell my friends and my girlfriends who call, if their child is suffering or their loved one in the home might be having thoughts of suicide, in addition to having those caring, supportive conversations and helping lead them to, you know, proper treatment and support, the other number one thing they can do to help keep their loved one safe is to clear the environment of lethal means as much as possible. And, you know, that if the family is a firearm-owning family, then absolutely that includes temporarily storing those guns outside the home if possible. But it also means any toxic substances, medications, sharps, get them out of harm's way and really secure them. And the truth is, this kind of suffering and crisis does not go on forever. It's a circumscribed period of time. Yes. And people do find their resilience and their, you know, that survival instinct and their sense of hope for the future. It's a very dynamic process in a person's life. So they do come back to that.
It's not about taking away people's guns or gun control. It's about understanding that, as you mentioned, if we can keep someone who's in a very low state away from a lethal means, then we can get them through that acute event. That's what we mean when we say lethal means safety. And there are simple things like making sure you keep your guns locked up if you do have guns in your house so they're not easily accessible. There are simple things like making sure if someone is having a mental health crisis that you have a conversation with them and their loved ones about what lethal means exist around the house. And how can we make sure we've got an eye on them and that they're secured to not have them available to someone when they're in an acute low moment? And so I just wanted to be very clear on that for folks, because this conversation about gun control and no one's going to take away my guns has obscured, I think, a much more important conversation about the fact that there are things that everyone agrees we can and should be doing to limit access to lethal means for people who are at risk of dying by suicide.
Thank you so much for highlighting that, because I think what binds all of us together, no matter what our other views are, is we all care about our loved ones. We all want ourselves and our community members, our friends and family, to be thriving and finding meaning and purpose and staying alive and really optimizing our mental health. So thank you so much for that. You know, I think one last conversation topic that I'd love to hear your thoughts on relates to social media and online, you know, screen activity, and, you know, the fact that there was a temporal association between the onset of and the utilization of social media and screen time and some of the mental health distress and in fact, rising suicide rates. But association and correlation does not necessarily mean causation. And the literature is a little complicated around that relationship between social media and mental health. So I would love to know your thoughts about that. And particularly because you have teenage kids, you know, how are you approaching this, you know, rather tricky subject that is just ubiquitous? I mean, everybody's got their screens and everyone is on, I shouldn't say everyone is on social media. Many people are using social media platforms.
No, it is really tough. And again, as you mentioned, I do have to kind of split my thinking about this up into buckets. As a parent, I am struggling just like every other parent out there to try to manage my children's usage of social media and screen time. And it is hard, because one of the things that we can't ignore is that young people use Snapchat. They use these social media platforms as a way of communicating, the way that we used our old phone that was wired into the wall back in the day to communicate with one another. And I'll give folks a concrete example, because it's easy to say social media is all bad, but here's why it's complicated. If you are someone who identifies as LGBTQ+, and you are in a rural community where there is no one around you who you see, who you know, who you can talk to about issues that are unique to you, then social media and screen time can be a lifeline for you. It can be a way to connect you to people who think like you, who look like you, who talk like you, who are going through the same struggles as you. So there can be good things that come out of it.
You can find this episode and past episodes of In Depth online at kcbsradio.com. You can also hear In Depth episodes on the Odyssey app. Thanks for listening. For KCBS and In Depth, I'm Mary Hughes.
You've been listening to KCBS In Depth. Get every episode by subscribing on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Visit kcbsradio.com for more news and interviews. We are the Bay Area's news station, KCBS.